And wonderful to have your company this afternoon, Verity Johnson and Peter Fahey with me, Wallace Chapman on the panel, RNZ National. Now, before we get to our question of the day, to the topic first, it has been 1 year today since the first e-scooters hit the streets thanks to Lime. Their arrival marked a new era of e-transport popping up all over the country, flummoxing local authorities, frustrating pedestrians and cyclists at the same time as also being embraced by city workers, commuters, students, residents. The scooters have sparked debates about helmets, speeds, alcohol restriction, age limits, where they should be ridden. The cost of related accidents has topped $4.3 million, but also reduced urban carbon emissions and saved nearly a million litres of petrol consumption. Last month, 23-year-old Tobin Hunter died after falling off a Lime scooter, believed to be the first death from an e-scooter in New Zealand. The uptake in Aotearoa has been described as massive. So far nationwide, more than 4 million Lime scooter rides have been recorded. Around the panel first up, have you ridden them? Do you ride them? Verity.
Of course I do, like almost every day, because I try to get around the CBD and I don't want to constantly be burning the environment because I have a future to think about, and I use electric scooters because they're great.
And what are they like to ride? I've never ridden one.
They're so fun. You feel like you're flying.
Dangerous.
You feel like Superman.
Dangerous.
Fun.
Very dangerous,
fun.
Eh?
No, fun. They're not dangerous.
They look dangerous. Their centre of gravity is all over the place.
No, what's dangerous is people who walk on the pavement with their headphones in on their phone texting. Yeah. They are far more dangerous than people on scooters, because when you're on your scooter, you're like alert, you're trying to like watch for things, you're dodging, you are present. When you are walking on the street texting and also listening to music and like walking in front of cars and bumping into people, that's when you're dangerous.
Peter, do you ride them?
No, because I'm scared of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I fear them. And that just, you know, it just shows my age, but I do fear them a little bit. And secondly, yeah, I just haven't had any interest of trying them.
Because you walk.
Yeah, because I walk.
Because you walk.
So, I'm a type of an individual that likes to know that they've walked a certain, you know,
oh, do
level.
You count your steps?
Yeah, certain level per day.
Oh,
so,
yep.
And also I'm out in Pukekohe, so there's no Lime scooters out of Puke.
Keep going.
Oh, I was just going to say, I also consider them a real triumph for women, because like when you're getting catcalled when you're walking on the street, it's much harder to catcall you if you're on a scooter because you're really fast. So like you can zip past before they can get the words out. So it's actually really good.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah. Isn't it hard to believe, both of you, that 366 days ago, we didn't have an inkling of what a Lime scooter was or other brands? They just appeared, didn't they?
Mm.
They just appeared.
They did, like that, and the world was
and
changed.
So my question to you is, the world has changed, but have they changed for the better?
Yes, I think it's a great improvement. I like to have more options to get around. I like to have environmentally transport options. I like to be able to go places quickly, like at night if you're walking home and you don't feel safe because you're walking and you feel exposed. If you're on a scooter, you feel safer because you are faster, you're harder to catch, you know, you've got a weapon if you needed to hit someone with it. Mm. So,
but then there are the injuries, Verity. Here's where it gets hairy. The injuries can be horrific, as bad as car crashes, said one article. You know, so for example, Liam Thompson, who broke his jaw, I've been reading about this, after being thrown over the handlebar of his Lime scooter after its brakes locked up.
Yeah, they did have...
That's scary stuff.
They did have glitches, yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, everything in general has a risk. I mean, walking in general, driving a car in general, there's always a risk you might get hit, you might fall over, like... The whole part of, yes, they cause accidents. Well, everything causes accidents. You know, I don't think they are disproportionately more dangerous than many other options out there. If you're a cyclist in Auckland, I find that way scarier than driving a Lime. Because if you're a cyclist in Auckland, people will car door you, you can't see you, you know, you get hit, people swear at you, people shout, people throw things. It doesn't happen on a Lime.
And that's a bit of a concern when you've got motorists who will go to that end. What, you know, because there's some out there who look at cyclists with, you know, with hatred.
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully this doesn't happen. But you can sort of see that with some motorists, and you can sort of see it coming. You know, with scooters as well. And hopefully not. But unfortunately, there are some motorists out there who just have this hate in their eyes when they see other forms of transport.
Someone says, Sue says, in Adelaide last week noted all scooters came with a helmet attached. So every particular city around the world, because this particular issue that we're talking about has been discussed at length in various cities. As soon as they started in Santa Monica and in the States, and they branched out from there. What are the next rules? Helmets or keeping them to the cycle lanes? What do you think, Verity?
I think probably they'll keep them to the cycle lanes. It's probably easier than getting a helmet. And I also think that might be slightly more appropriate. If you're worried about hitting pedestrians, it's better if you're in a cycle lane, and then you can keep to the left of the cycle lane and you can be lapped by all those really, fast men in tight lycra who like to zip everywhere. I think that's probably a safer bet.
Yeah, Catherine says, Auckland is different to Wellington. Slow them down to 10 kilometres per hour, then see if your panel still want them. Get them off the footpath.
I love them at 10 kilometres.
So you don't mind going slow?
No, it's a nice, it's a fun thing to do. You can have a stroll on your scooter. You can look at things. You can watch the birds. I enjoy it.
Mm. All right. Okay, so some of your responses for our question of the day. Love them, says someone. As a motorcycle rider, I probably have a bit more caution than many users, but haven't had any negative experiences with my e-scooter rides. Another one, for stability, these scooters should have wheels with about 3 to 5 times the diameter and 2 to 3 times the width for stability. We need some laws governing them because things are a bit chaotic and dangerous right now, especially for the very elderly and very young. Another one here, they were a wonderful way to get around the city after a knee replacement. The scooters are great. Shame about some of the fools that ride them. Wonder if we could legislate them out of our city. As an elderly pedestrian, they terrify me. I walk across Victoria Bridge in Hamilton on a relatively narrow footpath, and I just know that either me or a scooter rider is going to end up sprawled on the road in front of a car one day. Many, many more. As a slightly disabled pensioner, I have given up going downtown since those damn scooters arrived. In theory, great, not so long as they're ridden on footpaths. And just a couple more here. I've had 2 knee ops and sometimes am pram pushing. They are a real menace. I loathe them. They need to be on the road. Then I'll probably get one. And another one. As a pedestrian in the CBD, I've been hit by someone on a Lime scooter twice, an average 1 near miss every few weeks. I haven't been on one yet. So there's a really large range of responses. But if I can just sum them all up, Peter, one thing is inescapable. The roads now are for sharing, and we just can't go back to having one mode of transport adopting using our roads and footpaths, can we?
Yeah,
so now it's a sharing thing now.
And it's the point that Verity said, it's choice. It's options and choices are a beautiful thing for human beings, and that's what it is. It's just a choice.
I completely agree with that, yeah. And I think that we need to start thinking about, like you said, sharing in the future, and if we want to tackle climate change, maybe some more electric things?
More electric things. Okay. It's 20 to 5 on the panel, RNZ National. On a completely different note, in an article in the Otago Daily Times, University of Otago International Relations Specialist says that the government of New Zealand is behaving irresponsibly by not bringing New Zealand jihadist Mark Taylor home and to account. Professor Robert Patman says that with the release now of prisoners post-US withdrawal from Syria's northern border, the likes of Mark Taylor and others, hardened jihadists, would be able to regroup and reignite the activities of terror. This being on the back of the US withdrawal in the area, leaving a vacuum that allowed Turkey to launch an assault on the Kurds, who are widely considered the spearhead against ISIS in the region. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has previously said Taylor would receive no assistance from the New Zealand government. So before we go to Professor Papman, Peter, what do you make of this? And here, maybe put your Amnesty International hat on. The US has urged countries, including New Zealand, to repatriate their citizens who joined ISIS, but our government remains reluctant.
I mean, firstly, we've got a long history of extradition within our country. So, with those New Zealand citizens who have committed a crime overseas, they're either, prosecuted under the laws of those countries, or they've extradited home to be prosecuted. And any criminal or alleged criminal, who takes an act against other human beings, against humanity, against society, should also be fully prosecuted under the law of New Zealand. The challenge that we've got in New Zealand is that this would be the first of its type in terms of bringing charges under our current terrorism acts. I think that's the concern for most people. And I think if you were to get a couple of lawyers on there, they'll say the same thing. So you've got the legal fraternity or the justice system sort of rolling, trying to adapt our current laws to a citizen of our country who's coming back to New Zealand to be prosecuted under what will probably be anti-terrorism laws, and also then go and then having to satisfy a certain threshold, because of course you know the social media accounts show that he's a supporter of, not a participant.
So he might not even meet the threshold.
And then you've got the political issue that comes with that, where you've got a citizen with those ideas who you're bringing back into the country. So, and it's unlikely to be de-radicalised like other countries have, where other countries have de-radicalisation programs. So this is a whole new field for New Zealand: justice system, police system, intelligence system, human rights system as well. So it's a careful one, and I can see why like people like the Minister of Justice is sort of carefully looking at it. However, it's
so no easy answers.
There's no easy answer, and I think that's the challenge for any government of the day, where you've got a citizen who you need to be back.
Well, here's an easier way to think about, because a lot of Kiwis would say, look, you know what? He made his own way there. He can make his own way back. There isn't a lot of compassion out there for the New Zealand jihadi. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I kind of agree. I don't have an extraordinary amount of compassion for him. I don't even... If you think about the more pressing issues that are happening at home right here, right now, I don't have a lot of sympathy left for him in that sense. I'm not going to expend a lot of energy fighting for this.
And nor his family. His family has disowned him as well. And that's the other part of bringing such a citizen back into New Zealand as well. So it's difficult, but at the end of the day, he's a citizen of our country in which we need to prosecute as part of our own legal system.
I'm just thinking before we go, or have they disowned him? I'm just trying to think, weren't they supporting him? Maybe I can clarify that a bit later on. But anyway, we're with Professor Robert Papman from the University of Otago. Professor Papman, welcome.
Oh, good afternoon, Wallace.
Yeah, so look, you say it's irresponsible. In fact, you say it's doubly irresponsible to leave him there. How so?
Well, I think it's not a question of compassion to bring him back to New Zealand. Let's be quite clear about this. We joined an anti-ISIS coalition back in 2014, we contributed troops which trained Iraqi forces against the ISIS threat. And we have responsibilities as part of that coalition. Now, I said back in March, before the Christchurch atrocity, that this guy needs to be taken out of circulation. I mean, this guy, it was part of an organization. He may not have been, we don't know to what extent he participated in the atrocities, but the organization which he belonged to is a criminal organization which murdered Syrians, Kurds, and Iraqis in large numbers and sometimes in the most hideous circumstances. And, when it became public that when the Kurds basically first asked the New Zealand government to take this guy back, we heard all these populist noises like, oh, we don't want him back. We've got, no compassion and... he's made his own bed, he must lie on it, and Kiwis don't really care about this. Well, actually, we do care because we joined a coalition. We do care about blunting terrorism, and we do care about preventing these sort of atrocities occurring in the world, and we doubly care after what happened at Christchurch. So this guy really should be brought back as quickly as possible. We still have 95 troops in Iraq. He should be put on the first plane back and face the full rigor of the law. Now, I take the point there are legal complexities, but nevertheless, I do think he should not be... We're now in the absurd situation where our government's divvied, and now he will probably be free to resume his activities of creating mayhem and possible atrocities in the Middle East. And this is not a good look.
Right, so you're saying that the government of New Zealand really is dithering on this issue.
Well, yes, we seem to be saying, oh, yes, on the one hand, we're meeting our responsibilities under Geneva Convention. He is a Kiwi citizen, but we're not in a hurry to bring him home. If he can make his own way to Ankara and get himself on a plane, we'll deal with him. But, there's a big false assumption here. That is that this is a soft option of bringing him home. It's not a soft option. He needs to be taken out of circulation. so that he's not free to commit atrocities anywhere or contribute to an organisation that is. He needs to be brought back under the Terrorist Suppression Act and tried in the most rigorous fashion. And also, he's not the only Kiwi who has volunteered to participate in jihadist organisations. So it's important that we look in the eyes of other countries, businesslike, and, you know, we have a, in short, we have a powerful strategic reason and diplomatic reason for dealing with this in a very businesslike and professional fashion.
Hey, before, while we have you here, I mean, this news of the US withdrawal is really big news internationally. I mean, front page of like the likes of The Guardian and BBC. I'm just looking at the New York Times right now. It's really big news. So on that note, what of the vacuum that the US is leaving? Reading The Guardian today, they note that the real power shift was between Washington, whose fighting troops have all but left the region 16 years after invading Iraq, and Moscow, whose reach and influence now is across the US, across the Middle East, and that's now been cemented. What's your take on it?
No, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I think what has happened is that both Mr. Obama and, to a greater extent, Mr. Trump have reduced America's involvement in conflicts in the Middle East. And the one foothold that the Russians have is in Syria. And basically, they've extended that. It was very irresponsible what, in my view, what Mr. Trump did, which was essentially give the green light to the Turkish incursion in northern Syria. So they can pursue their number one enemy. The Turkish government of Mr. Erdogan always made it clear their number one enemy was the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds who fought in the SDF, who actually did the lion's share of the fighting on behalf of the anti-ISIS coalition led by the United States. They did they did the bulk of the fighting against ISIS and played a key role in defeating ISIS. And now the United States has turned its back on the Syrian Kurds. So that, I think, is, you know, it highlights the fact that we have very few mechanisms internationally in which nations which don't have statehood can transition to statehood. And at the moment, they've just been abandoned by everyone, it seems to me.
Professor Robert Papman, University of Otago, thank you very much for explaining and being on the show. It's quite tragic what's happening there, isn't
and
it?
And with Erdogan, it's taken, I mean, he's been in power 16 years, and it's taken him 60 years now to sort of, you know, create a neo-Ottoman empire. So this is his opportunity. And as the professor said, you know, the Kurds were his number one enemy. He's, you know, taken a secular nation of Turkey and turned it into a, you know, an Islamic state. And it's taken him 16 years, and he's got the opportunity. And of course, troops will be, you know, at the end of the day, those civilians will be the ones that will be killed and maimed and hurt through this, and we'll probably have another wave of Syrian, northern Syrian and Kurdish refugees coming out of that area.
10 away from 5 on the panel, RNZ National. With me is Peter Fa'afi'i and Verity Johnson today. To this story here, I've been wanting to sort of talk about this for a wee while, but here it is. Calls again for a sugar tax, this time by Associate Health Minister, who says that diabetes is affecting my people, to quote Penny Henare in the New Zealand Herald a couple of days ago. Nearly a quarter of a million New Zealanders have diabetes, another 100,000 thought to be undiagnosed. About 90% have type 2, mostly brought on by lifestyle and linked to obesity. Now, new figures show that diabetes caused more than 1,000 amputations every year in New Zealand. That is a 22% surge over 5 years. The issue was also personal to him. Diabetes had cost his own relatives limb and health. Henare says that measures like a sugar tax should be considered to drive up the cost of junk food. Now, Catherine Rich of the Food and Grocery Council said that extra taxes on treats like chocolate or other high-calorie foods will make New Zealanders poorer as they try to feed their families, and it's the wrong policy to nudge people towards a healthy diet. Peter, you start first on this. I mean, this sugar tax thing, I mean, it's like the topic that won't go away, right? And it's quite a divisive topic too. Quite a lot of pushback from people who will say that they are, or actually industry who will say, look, they are already voluntarily cutting back on sugar. What's your take on this issue?
I mean, Pina Hinata has been a good minister, right? He's been a good health minister in that he's trying to create a toolkit in order to fight a battle that New Zealand as a country has been losing for 25 years, right? And that's diabetes. We're losing the battle against diabetes. So as a good minister, he's creating a toolkit of measures. One of them, you know, one of them is around funding Pharmac more, another is more campaigns, a third is targeted campaigns, and the fourth is sugar tax. So all it is just a raft of measures that he's looking at. Now, to focus on the sugar tax issue and to use Mexico as an example, there's 29 other countries who have sugar tax, right? And that's what the media have missed, that there's 30 countries around the world who have sugar tax, and it's just one measure. And as a good minister, he's throwing those ideas out. I think the failure on this government is the Prime Minister's immediate reaction two days later when she said that's not going to happen. I mean that's putting your minister out on a limb, but secondly, you're putting his good work as a good minister to do, which is testing the waters on every measure to deal with such a massive health issues, and to put him under the bus like that, that's pretty unfair.
What's your take on this, Verity?
No, I agree with a lot of actually what you just said.
But not all of it
in that, well, for me, the thing that won't go away is that sugar and overindulging in sugary food is a product of people who, like, it's an exhausted lifestyle, right? You work three jobs, you have lots of kids. You know, if you are on the go constantly, you're drinking V, you're drinking Red Bull, you're drinking Fizzy, you're drinking lots of stuff to keep going. So if you are living a lifestyle which is characterized by poverty and by exhaustion, of course you're going to have sugar, of course, because it makes you feel good because you want to keep going. It's like smoking, right? Like, you smoke to keep going. So is it going to work? I don't know. Do I think that poverty and issues around, like, the unstable gig economy, around people being trapped in unperforming jobs and being underpaid, do I think that those problems are going to go away? No. Yeah. I think those problems are always going to create an environment where you smoke or you eat sugary stuff.
You mentioned the smoking thing. Hinata did say that, to quote, smoking cessation campaign has blunt tools and it had sharp tools in its arsenal that made a really significant difference. And I'm serious of the opinion that that's what it's going to take for diabetes. So around the panel, I guess, can we make the same assumptions that a price indicator that worked for smoking will actually work for sugar? Do we know that? What do you think?
I don't know.
We'll put it out to our audience. Text us 2101. What I do know, Peter, as fellow Pacifica, the diabetes issue, it looms front and centre, doesn't it, in terms of the community?
Oh, it does. And you know, my father's, you know, suffers from type 2 diabetes.
Really?
Yeah. My uncle has as well. So it's front and centre, but also, you know, as Verity said, it's a lifestyle issue as well. So it's about, you know, getting some of those campaigns out to and targeting you know, specific cohorts of our society, men as well, because, you know, in terms of amputations, men are disproportionately affected as well. So so it's a battle that's hard fought, with more to come, really.
And others would say you can talk about lifestyle, but when you're living in an environment where all you see in your 1 kilometre radius is food that is totally obesogenic.
Oh, absolutely. And you are targeted.
What choices do you have?
Yeah. And that's exactly how companies work. They're like, we're going to target the most vulnerable people and put the most awful things in front of them because they want to buy it. And I think that's really just... What's also really interesting is how sugar has become one of these things where, like, if you are middle class, you now hate sugar. So you're actually going to have a great... If we tax sugar, middle class people are going to be like, this is great, because middle class people are moving away from sugar. Sugar is the new evil. So you're just going to create an even bigger, like, class divide. And it really just... We're not going to solve this until we solve underlying issues of poverty and inequality in New Zealand.
That's an interesting topic. Quite a bit of response to that. I don't know whether or not you think that a sugar tax will be part of the solution or not. It's 4 away from 5 this afternoon. Now, is technology and online slang running the risk of ruining languages altogether? A Guardian article has looked into the phenomenon of replacing words with just letters to form sentences. This is one for you, Verity. and the increased use of emoticons to communicate. Apparently the trend to stop using punctuation and start relying on hashtags to make a point all began with the users of the microblogging site Tumblr. So is there a danger that written language is under threat, or is this something you'd be hope will be confined to the virtual world? Hashtag Verity Johnson.
Hashtag moral hysteria. I love this idea that language is this one block of immoving concrete things that are under attack. Language has always evolved. Language is a constantly fluid, evolving concept. And just because some people don't use commas, it doesn't mean that people have somehow like degraded
there
the basis of English.
There are standards, though, isn't there? There is a proper English. There's a standard.
But there are contexts.
That you don't subscribe to because you're too lazy.
No, that's not true at all. There's context for different things. If I am going to write a report to my boss, I am still going to use all of the proper words and the commas and the appropriate language. I'm not going to be like, lol, jokes. Am I? But if I'm writing an Instagram post, of course I'm going to be like, lol, jokes. Because that's how you do it. You just change context depending on where you're writing. And I don't think that it makes it worse. I just think it makes it different.
I remember the day when I used, you know, the term lit. You know, and my six kids, you know, were laughing, you know, laughing in the living room, and you know, and my one of them had to actually open the landslide and go out because he was laughing so hard. And I said, "What's the deal? What? I'm describing this music.
I'm being cool.
I'm being cool."
They were teasing you. Oh, Dad.
Oh, that's great. But you can use it ironically now for like maximizing your own laughter. Yeah, it's like woke. You know, you can use that ironically because woke has gone out of fashion.
Oh. Let me put it to you both. Do you think language should change, or should we keep it? Should we keep it as is?
It needs to
certain
change.
Standard.
Evolve. Just like
embrace.
Human beings.
Embrace. Take on new things. Get exciting. Exactly. Get crafty. Get expressive.
We are human beings, not bots.
No. Peter Fa'afiu and Verity Johnson, thank you so much for your wonderful, wonderful opinions this afternoon
thank
on the
you.
Panel.
Thank
I'm Wallace Chapman. See you tomorrow at 3:45. Checkpoint next.